House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 15th. Just for information, if you have the agenda ahead in front of you, we're going to carry over House Bill 2183, House Bill 3204, House Bill 3594, House Bill 2142, House Bill 2650, and House Bill 3295. Open a public hearing on House H.J.R. 34.
Chairman of the Committee, H.J.R. 34 comes to you from Representative Barker, Krieger, Matthews. It refers to the vote as an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow legislative assembly to prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors so long as a prohibition is consistent with the United States Constitution.
Thank you, Council. And today we have a pretty full schedule, even with carrying over those bills. So I'm going to ask people to be brief. If you submit written testimony, we will read it. You don't need to repeat it. If you would summarize it, please, because we have a lot of stuff to get through before we run out of time this next Friday. Thank you. Representative Olson, please. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I am state representative out of the Albany area. Actually, Mr. Chair, I am going to read a portion of my testimony, if you don't mind. And you do have that in front of you, so I guess you can always, you know, catch up to me later. Or penalty, I guess, I reckon. No healthy parent wants to think about his or her child viewing pornography, but it often happens. Some researchers have stated that the average age of exposure to pornography is down to 8. Before the days of the internet, children were typically between ages 11 to 13 when they began by viewing softcore pornography found in magazines like Playboy. Today's child lives in a culture where hardcore pornography abounds. Our children are being seduced daily, and we need to bear this fact in mind whenever we have the occasion to redirect them away from pornography. Clinical psychologist David Byrd from Corvallis stated sexual addiction is the fastest growing addiction in the United States. It's based in part on the fact that obtaining sexual literature, pornography, is so convenient today. It's more readily available. It is there at the click of the finger. H.J.R. 34 is a new provision of Article 1, which would be Section 46 of the Oregon Constitution, that prevents harm from occurring to our children. It allows the Oregon legislature the ability to create boundaries that protect our children from the harm of sexually explicit material. Article 1, Section 8 right now of our Constitution reads as this: "No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right." H.J.R. 34 adds this language to Article 1. "The Legislative Assembly may prohibit the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors in any manner consistent with the United States Constitution." This last September, the Ninth Circuit Court put Oregon between a rock and a hard spot. The court struck down ORS 167.054, furnishing sexually explicit material to a minor, and struck down half of ORS 167.057, luring a minor with the use of sexually explicit material as unconstitutional, specifically when the material is used to arouse a person or the minor. The court left standing the crime when the material is used to induce a minor to engage in sexual conduct. Both laws were created to protect children from harm by exposing them to sexually explicit material. Both those laws came from House Bill 2843 during the 07 session, which passed through this building overwhelmingly with only 3 votes that voted in opposition to the bill. Now, I just want to take a moment out here and catch up to what was the main theme of what was happening with House Bill 2843 and the 2 statutes that I had mentioned. The criteria was that we were focusing at children and the child being the age being age 13. The reasoning behind that is because at that time, the majority of clinical psychologists had determined that there is a true line in age for maturity for when And we're talking specifically boys here now, because I'll explain this a little bit more as I get into my testimony. For when their first exposure occurs, and that specifically Dr. Archibald Hart, in his book known as The Hart Report, had done extensive research in this area and found that that was to be the age that really had some serious impact. Prior to age 13, and it seemed like there was just a maturity level that triggered in for those that were after that age. So that's what was based on House Bill 2843 as we moved forward with those two laws. Many of you have heard one of the most famous expressions made in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Potter Stewart was attempting to describe a threshold test for describing pornography in Jacobellis versus Ohio. And obscenity is not protected speech under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and can therefore be censored. And this is what he said. The justice said, "I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it." And I think we've all heard that one a few times. Let me read the definition of the type of pornography we are talking about. That's found in the two mentioned statutes that Powell Bookstore and others felt was okay for children's viewing. Sexually explicit material means material containing visual images of human masturbation or sexual intercourse, genital to genital, oral to genital, anal to genital, or oral anal contact, whether between persons of the same or opposite sex or between humans and animals, or penetration of the vagina or rectum by any object other than a part of personal hygiene practice. That's what we were trying to do with the bill 4 years ago. Oregon has failed to stay up with the times in protecting our children and thus our future. It has been said that the eyes are the windows of the soul. Boys and girls are wired entirely different. Boys respond visually. There is so much clinical research to support that statement. But let me read just a quote from Anita Sethi, who's a clinical psychologist. She says, "Even though I am a psychologist who specializes in early education, it took having kids to make me realize that sex differences aren't just the stuff of Brady Bunch reruns. In fact, only one study found that when 18-month-old boys and girls were shown pictures of a doll and a vehicle, for example, most of the girls opted for the doll, and while the majority of the boys chose the vehicle. And the vehicle, and while 18 months is old, enough have been influenced by stereotype gifts, research suggests that many of the differences we see are evident from birth and may even be hardwired." That's what a clinical psychologist said. I want this committee to realize the urgency in moving this bill forward to the voters. It is good to be recognized as a pioneer state and support our Bill of Rights. But to ignore efforts to protect our children from harm is a crime. Now, I just want to close with this because last week, 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm extremely passionate about this. I was lying awake 1 o'clock in the morning, and I found myself having to jump on the internet and do some research. And I tracked and followed one website to an interview where Dr. James Dobson interviewed Ted Bundy, if you remember Ted, back in 1989. It was just hours before he was executed in an electric chair down in Florida. Ted Bundy had confessed to committing 30 murders of women across the nation. There was at least in the neighborhood of about 100 other, or I mean a total of 100 murders that were involved in that as well, that were suspected that he was the individual who had committed the murder. But those are unfounded as of today. During this interview, I'll tell you, this was a very disturbing interview. It was only a half hour long. But one of the questions that Dr. Dobson asked Ted Bundy was, "How did it start?" And he painted the picture for us that between ages 10 to 12, he saw his first magazine of pornography. And it was Playboy, and he found it in a garbage can. Now, granted, Playboy isn't even where we're going. It doesn't even come close to what we're trying to do here with this description, because sexually explicit material is extremely graphic, as I just read to you. But the point being is it triggered something in him that created an insatiable appetite that would cause him down a path later in his life that he would take other people's lives. And it was killing a 12-year-old little girl that caught him and finally brought him to justice back in Florida. So I appreciate you listening to me, and Mr. Chair, I think probably at this point would be best is to just move forward with the panel.
Thank you, Representative. I call Jason Carlisle and Brad Berry, please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jason Carlisle, Linn County District Attorney since 1988, and a prosecutor before then. I'm here to encourage passage of House Joint Resolution Number 34 because it's an important legal tool to help us protect children and to protect them from those that would use these sexually explicit materials to hunt for children that they can abuse. The resolution itself gives an important clue, if you will, as to why it's important. Remember, in the United States, we're dealing with two constitutions, both the United States Constitution and the Oregon Constitution. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that you can regulate obscene materials that are provided to children. And there have been statutes in other states which the United States Supreme Court has approved. So we have some models for statutory tools that we can use that have been approved by the United States Supreme Court. However, as you, I'm sure some of you are lawyers, God bless you and save you, the Oregon Supreme Court has taken the position that we can interpret the Oregon Constitution differently from the United States Supreme Court. This joint resolution allows us to have one target to shoot at, one set of laws, and so that we can know the pattern that will be approved for these statutes that we can use to attack this terrible new phenomenon that we're seeing. So we want the Oregon Constitution to be in alignment with the U.S. Constitution so we can pass statutes which will allow us to protect our children. Mr. Berry?
Thank you. Chair Krieger and Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I, too, am here to urge your passing, forwarding HGR 34 to the voters for amendment to the Constitution as this is listed. I'm going to be quick. I know there's a lot going on today, but I want to point out a couple of things. First, as Mr. Carlisle mentioned, many, many states' constitutions are typically reviewed by their Supreme Court to be in line with the U.S. Constitution. In other words, as you may recall from civics long ago, as each state gained statehood, they were required to pass a constitution which was consistent with the United States Constitution. And in fact, the federal government ultimately ruled whether the Constitution was, the state proposed state constitution, was or was not consistent with the United States Constitution. And if it was deemed not to be, it was sent back to the state before statehood was granted. In most states, they have consistently utilize the state constitution and how they review it to be consistent with the United States Constitution, and in particular in search and seizure law. As those of you who have engaged in criminal practice know, since the mid, actually Mr. Taylor reminded me, it was about the mid-80s, I thought it was actually before that, the Oregon Supreme Court at that point diverged in their review of the Oregon Constitution, indicating that in fact the Oregon Constitution had additional protections for the people in abuses by the government or they deemed an authority of the government beyond that granted by the United States Constitution. And since that time, we continue to debate what the Oregon Constitution allows that, in fact, the Oregon Constitution prohibits, and in fact, the United States Constitution may allow. What this HDR does is say, as for this one small area, the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors, in that area, we will have a consistent approach with that of the United States Constitution. This is actually a bill which provides for expeditious review of laws that this body may pass in the future. It allows us to actually reach out to other states who have passed laws, who attempt to achieve the same thing that this body did 4 years ago. Those laws have been reviewed by the United States Supreme Court and deemed to be constitutional. We don't have to recreate the wheel, and we don't have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars debating whether or not the Oregon Constitution requires something different than, in fact, the United States Constitution. Now, having said that, and as I close, I want to remind you that this is more than about a law and how we pass a law that is acceptable to our Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. This is about children. The furnishing of these materials, we talk of grooming. In fact, these cases talked about overt action of grooming. The providing of these materials to children is a harm in and of itself. If it goes no further, if the person providing these materials to the children does nothing beyond that, the harm is done by giving these materials, assimilating these children to those types of materials is harm in and of itself. That's where the real problem arena comes here. And in fact, I was mentioning to Mr. Carlisle before we came in here, I cannot recall a case. And as Jason said, we may well have had one, but I do not recall a child abuse case where the child reporting the abuse against them did not also talk about pornography being given to them, shown to them, provided to them at some point early on as the process began. We know where this starts. We also know from the studies, from the psychologists, and the science that just the acclimating these children to these materials is harmful in and of itself.
And indeed, this offense currently against humanity, hopefully soon against the state, is a harm in and of itself. And I wonder if the witnesses could discuss anecdotally, for example, when the police come across a house in which there's substantial drug activity, methamphetamine, let's say, children also residing there. Could you comment on whether there's also a common factor of hardcore pornography also present? Do you know whether that's common in these types of cases? I mean, the police go to a house, there's kids there, there's drugs, methamphetamine in particular there. Is there commonly also hardcore pornography?
Often so. In fact, the world of investigation and police work has changed over the years. Now, whenever we go into a house to search for drugs, we always look at the computer, and on the computer, you frequently find a number of these materials. And as Brad has suggested, those materials are often used to help groom the children for further things. I won't say in every case, but many, many times they run parallel.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I understand the point about consistency between state constitutions and the U.S. Constitution. Am I correct in understanding your comments to mean that a state cannot prohibit something that is permitted by the federal government, but it can extend additional protections to its citizens that the U.S. Constitution does not include?
Chairs Krieger and Barker, Representative Nolan, yes, that's correct. The state Supreme Court is allowed to review and make decisions on the state constitution which restrict government further than the United States Constitution restricts government actions by the United States Supreme Court. However, you could not use a state constitution to authorize government action more liberally than the United States Constitution has been interpreted.
And a quick follow-up. Isn't essentially the joint resolution in front of us an example of that, where the Oregon citizenry retains to itself the right to amend its constitution, and we have historically over years added lots and lots of amendments to our constitution that diverge from the U.S. Constitution without being inconsistent with it?
Chairs Krieger and Barker, Representative Nolan, members of the committee. Let me see if I can carefully respond to that question, Representative Nolan. The citizens of Oregon, I think, have been active, especially through the initiative process, in utilizing the Constitution to ensure that certain things are done or not done. And in fact, again, getting back to search and seizure law, because I think it really illustrates the point you're getting at, the Oregon Supreme Court has specifically stated that the Oregon Constitution does have more limitations on government than the United States Constitution. Now, the part I'm struggling with in your question is whether or not we have intentionally moved through amendments to the Constitution to be more restrictive on government or to be more proactive on government. Even if the citizenry were to pass an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that allowed for I could make something up, but for government to do something that is kind of way out there beyond what the U.S. Constitution would allow, the U.S. Constitution would trump. It's only where we further limit government's actions that we could actually interpret the Oregon Constitution or create provisions to the Oregon Constitution which would further limit it.
And one final follow-up. I certainly don't want to get into a constitutional debate with you because I'm sure you'd win.
I'm not so sure.
But part of my point is that the requirement from the U.S. Constitution is that the states be consistent, not identical. Because if the requirement were that we be identical, then it would simply be a matter of the states adopting the U.S. Constitution, just as many national membership organizations require their local chapters to simply adopt their national bylaws. The U.S. Constitution didn't do that. It said you have to be consistent, not identical.
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, members of the committee, yes, that's absolutely accurate. The simplicity of this HJR, by limiting this one small area for requiring consistent interpretation, allows this body, if this is passed by the voters, allows this body in relatively short order to again pass laws that will protect children that we know have already been deemed to be constitutionally adequate.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And it's my memory that it was in the 70s when the changes came about under the Hans Lindy Court.
But Chair Barker, I've learned long ago not to disagree with Mr. Taylor in public. So
I've learned a long time ago not to disagree with the chairs.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next we call Andrea Meyer, Candace Morgan, P.K. Runkles Pearson, and Mary
Ganeen.
If you could, about 20 minutes, please.
Absolutely. Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director of the ACLU of Oregon, today here in opposition to HJR 34, which is a constitutional amendment to weaken our free expression provision, Article 1, Section 8. And we believe it's not necessary to weaken our free expression provision to protect minors against sexual abuse. But if passed, this constitutional amendment would create significant confusion and likely litigation. As way of background, the state's constitutions were adopted after the U.S. Constitution as it moved from east to west. The pattern was to make the Bill of Rights more explicit and more protective of individual liberties than the federal Bill of Rights. And Oregon followed this pattern in 1857, and as one delegate stated to our convention, many changes have taken place since our fathers first formed constitutions. A great many things used to be considered right, which subsequent experience and the progress of age taught us are blots upon our nation. As a result, the delegates agreed to follow the Indiana's new Bill of Rights, adopted 6 years prior, and copied the free speech provision verbatim, precisely because it was more protective than the federal First Amendment. And this is deliberative. We know because we can look, as Bradbury mentioned, at our search and seizure provision, Article 1, Section 4. It is almost identical to the Fourth Amendment, but not our free expression provision. To be clear, even under our free expression provision, it does not mean anything goes. And Article 1, Section 8 also includes language that every person is responsible for the abuse of this right. We believe, or as you've heard testimony, that HJR 34 is a result of the ACLU of Oregon's successful challenge in Powell's books, And we challenge a portion of the legislation passed in 2007 prohibiting the furnishing of sexually explicit materials to minors. I want to emphasize the luring portion, and P.K. Ronkles-Pearson will testify next as the attorney for us and go into more detail. But our challenge to those statutes was limited in scope, and we did not challenge the provision that makes it a crime in Oregon to lure a minor by furnishing either visual or explicit verbal description of sexual conduct for the purpose of inducing a minor to engage in sexual conduct. That provision was and remains a C felony. And to be clear, ACLU does not seek to protect individuals who prey on minors for the purpose of engaging in sexual abuse. But we believe that the current Oregon laws already provide necessary protection. In addition to ORS 167.057, which is the law that remains in effect, ORS Chapter 163 covers the crimes of sexual offenses, rape, sodomy, unlawful sexual penetration, sexual abuse, online sexual corruption of a child, custodial sexual misconduct, using a child in the display of sexual explicit conduct, encouraging child sexual abuse, possession of materials depicting sexual explicit conduct of a child, and failure to report child pornography. In addition, Oregon law also has an attempt provision where these crimes constitute a substantial step forward, can also be charged. As I said, I'm going to let PK discuss a bit more about the Ninth Circuit decision, but I want to quote one part of the court's decision when it talked about sexually explicit material, the same language you have before you. As the Ninth Circuit Court wrote, analyzing the First Amendment, a host of material entitled to constitutional protection, ranging from standard sexual education materials to novels for children and young adults. That's what it covers. All the plaintiffs share the same concern, their ability to sell or provide constitutionally protected material that includes sexually related content to minors. We do not believe that the Oregon Constitution and the U.S. Constitution taken together provide barriers. I just want to briefly note the history recently in Oregon of bringing these issues to the voters. Oregonians have been asked three times in 17 years to amend Article 1, Section 8 for very similar purposes. Each time, they've made it clear they don't want the government to tell them what they can read, see, and hear. Now, while H.R. 34 focuses on sexually explicit material, at least two of the other ones in the amendments to the constitutional provisions invoked child pornography and obscenity. In 1994, it was Measure 19, and it again tried to align with the U.S. Constitution. That was rejected by voters. In 1996, it again invoked obscenity and child pornography, was rejected by voters. And finally, in 2000, the voters were asked for a third time in 6 years, and that had to do with zoning sexually oriented businesses. That proposal also failed. I think the vote in 2006 is informative. That was the last vote we had on Article 1, Section 8, and that did not have to do with regulating sexual material. Instead, it amended Article 1, Section 8 to allow for campaign finance restrictions similar to the U.S. Constitution. That was Measure 46. The statutory component was also put forward to the voters. It's important to note, the statutory provision passed. Voters approved the statutory, but by a vote of 60% to 40%, they rejected the amendment to Article 1, Section 8. And if you look at the voter pamphlet statements in that campaign, all but one, I think, in opposition, invoked free speech, from Planned Parenthood to Right to Life. They all urged that you not amend the Constitution that way. Proponents earlier have also invoked the same arguments today, and it's also fair to say Oregonians understand the issue. And with all due respect to the proponents, we don't believe this is necessary to protect our children. We believe we have very strong laws against any form of child abuse, and we do not need to amend our free expression provision to accomplish this goal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is P.K. Runkles-Pearson, and I'm an attorney at the law firm of Stoll Reeves, where I practice appellate law. I'm also a cooperating attorney for the ACLU. I'm here testifying in opposition to this resolution, and I'm here to provide the committee with context and information about the Powell's Books case, in which I represented the ACLU and other plaintiffs in the case. The plaintiffs in that case included not only the ACLU, but also, as you can tell from the caption, Powell's Books, as well as a coalition demolition of many other bookstores in our area. The booksellers in particular were concerned that laws like this could subject them to criminal liability simply by selling a book to a child. And in the statutes that were challenged, I'd like to correct a misapprehension that was raised earlier. The children who were talked about were not only under age 13, but the law also protected minors who are under the age of 17. So basically we're talking about everybody who's a teenager or younger. These booksellers were very concerned that simply and under ORS 167054, simply by selling a child a copy of a book that had what was defined as sexually explicit material in the statute, they could be on the hook for a felony. This is a big problem. Not only the booksellers, but also others challenged the law, including the Freedom to Read Foundation, which is affiliated with librarians, Ms. Morgan, who you'll hear from for a moment here, who could have been on the hook for criminal liability for providing something to her grandchild, and sex educators, who every day are on the front lines of trying to stop terrible things from happening to children and minors because of a lack of information about sexual matters. Now, as was mentioned earlier, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down significant portions of the statute, all the portions of the statute that we challenged in September. And the reason that they did so was not because the legislature didn't have good intentions in passing the law initially, and in fact, we think they did. The problem was that the legislature passed a law that was far too broad. And in so doing, it reached a lot of the constitutionally protected activities that I've already described. I'm going to give you more examples of that in a minute. Before I move on, though, I want to make clear what we did and what we did not challenge. We left untouched ORS 167057, 1B, large B. And that makes it a crime, a Class C felony, to lure a minor by furnishing to or using with a minor a visual representation or explicit verbal description or narrative account of sexual conduct, and doing this for the purpose of inducing the minor to engage in sexual conduct. We continue to believe that's a crime, we continue to believe that's a really bad thing, and we don't think that inducing a minor to engage in sexual conduct is protected. What we do have a problem with is simply the transmission of information, and that was what was criminalized by these laws, that's what we challenged, and that's what was struck down as overbroad. Prosecutors may still reach the behavior that was discussed earlier, the behavior that would lead to abuse of children, simply by charging defendants with luring a minor under the untouched provision, or by attempting to lure a minor under that provision. Now, the lesson of the Powell's Books case is what happens when good intentions go too far. To illustrate the overbreadth of the statutes, the plaintiff submitted to the court as exhibits 26 books that are commonly carried by bookstores or used by educators, which would violate the statutes if they were furnished to children or minors. Each of those books has serious value as to minors, and thus it is First Amendment-protected expression. But under the statutes that were passed, it would be unlawful to give to minors. And just I have a few examples of those today. I think it's very important to think about this when we're using the term pornography, which is a very broad term and doesn't really express a variety of expression that we're talking about. Here I have a book that we used as an exhibit, Exhibit 25. It's called Where Did I Come From? And you see it has a cartoon picture of what two people look like when they are engaged in sexual intercourse. This is the kind of thing that would have been a felony to give to a child under the law that was struck down. Other books include Mommy Laid an Egg or Where Do Babies Come From, which has more cartoon drawings. This is how it works, kids. This is what sex educators can use, or parents or grandparents, such as Ms. Morgan, to show people. This is what was being referred to as hardcore pornography. How Sex Works, which is a book that has photographs, which also was made for teens. Here we have, again, pictures just providing frank sexual information. Other kinds of books that would have been made unlawful under these statutes include Forever by Judy Blume, which is a classic book about a coming-of-age story, Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, which is a well-recognized work of literature, and Snow Falling on Cedars. Now, Snow Falling on Cedars and Slaughterhouse-Five are important books here because they have other serious value as to children. Snow Falling on Cedars is a book that's commonly taught in high schools for kids. Its primary theme is the terrible things that happened after and during World War II in Japanese internment camps. And yet, this would be unlawful to give to children. Slaughterhouse-Five is about the terrors of war and how awful that is. And yet, because of a short passage that has sexually explicit content, you could be on the hook criminally for these things. So that's what we're talking about. When we're when words like hardcore pornography are thrown out, they're not really talking about the kind of material that was banned under these statutes. I'd like to address what was raised earlier, the statement that providing these materials to children is a harm in and of itself, and I beg to differ with that. And the First Amendment also differs with that. In fact, in the Powell's Books case, citing case law that has been on the books for decades, the Ninth Circuit held yet again that materials that lead to a normal and healthy interest in sex are constitutionally protected under the First Amendment, under the federal Constitution. We also submitted materials, which I would be happy to discuss, and I won't now for lack of time, but I'd be happy to take questions on them, from experts in the field, child psychologist, a medical doctor, who explain that as a part of a child's normal and healthy sexual development, they should be exposed to materials that provide them with information about sex. And to illustrate the problem, I'll give you one brief example. In one of the declarations we submitted, a sex educator who works with younger teens had learned that there was so much misinformation out there about sex that it was leading kids into terrible situations simply because they didn't have the facts. And the primary, one of the rumors that was primarily she was combating was a rumor among preteens that if the woman, the girl, drank Mountain Dew before engaging in sex, she would not be become pregnant. These are the kinds of problems that sex educators are trying to deal with all the time. And sometimes the use of a drawing that may be explicit but is frank and honest can be sufficient to really stop a big problem. Furthermore, laws like this may have a chilling effect, encouraging people who know about the law, who learn about the possible problems of conveying material, to convey material, or to refrain from conveying material that isn't even precluded by the law, which is yet another reason why this law is a big problem. So with that, I think that that's an important lesson that the legislature needs to think about in terms of drafting these laws. And it's, we have a law there that is already protecting against the difficult problems that were described earlier. And so for that reason, I'd urge the committee not to pass this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I might ask.
Yes, question, please.
Thank you. My apologies to the committee, but I do have a question. And you're an excellent lawyer, and I can tell that. And one of the concerns I have is keeping our discussion here on track. And isn't it the case that every one of those books that you just cited would fall under the exclusions of the Miller case and are protected under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and therefore are not even addressed by this bill whatsoever? Isn't that the case?
That's true.
Okay, so really, that discussion and the pictures of cartoons which would not be affected by this whatsoever is not properly a part of the discussion. So I just want to make that clear, because it's very easy on these types of issues to go off in the wrong direction and to allow a slippery slope argument or a straw man argument, such as the one that you imputed to my colleague, that those would be banned by this rule or by this proposal. It's very easy to get distracted by that, but it's not proper. It's not proper argumentation, and it's not the way for us to have this conversation. And it's important to me that we keep it on track, please. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Representative Wan, thank you for the question. I think that the issue that I was trying to illustrate by this is the fact that we have a statute now that is responsive to the concerns that were raised. And this, as I'm sure you understand, this is a very complicated area of law. Many other states that don't have separate free speech provisions have tried to pass laws that work with the First Amendment, and those laws are actually constantly under challenge. And so my point is that this is the result of what happened with the last attempt to pass a law that went a little bit too far, and that the legislature should be careful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. My name is Candace Morgan. I'm a Portland resident and a retired librarian, and I'm also a grandmother. I was individually named plaintiff in the Powell's case, as you've heard, and on behalf of my grandson, as well as myself. And I think you might well ask, why in the world would she do that? And the reason I did that is that amending that particular bill, you've already heard about its difficulties in terms of its language and its very broad and vague definition of sexual behavior in relationship to whether it's for trying to go against predators or go against others who appropriately provide information. Representative Olson read to you from the statute about the definition of sexual activities. Many of those activities that are defined are perfectly normal activities. My concern, and another question that is reasonable to have to think about me, don't I care about child predators? I most certainly do. My grandson is 10. My daughter, his mother's partner, has twin 12-year-old girls. I am very concerned. They're part of my family. I'm concerned for all children. But it takes more than laws against sexual predators to protect children against sexual predators. It takes accurate, understandable knowledge about those very same sex acts and about what their appropriate place is. In order to do that with kids, you have to have it illustrated, you have to have it explained explicitly. And the problem with putting in our Constitution one exception that says explicit materials for minors in and of itself is chilling. When I realized, when I read the previous law that we challenged, that I who take, one of my jobs is to take my grandson to, I don't want to call it jog, it's a lot of fun. I take him to Powell's Bookstore, I take him to Annie Bloom's, I take him to the Hillsdale branch of the Multnomah County Library, and he goes and picks off things off the shelf, and I provide him with some advice. I'm trying to teach him to learn what is appropriate for himself. And the thought that seeing something just, if it's a sexually explicit, a sex education book, like It's Perfectly Normal, this was one of the ones, when this book is intended for children 10 and above, but it does have explicit cartoon-like, not photos, of the same kind of activities that Representative Olson read to you. So for those reasons, I am very, very concerned about adding this to a constitution. I don't think we need it. I think the laws are very, very well expressed in our statutes. So I would urge you not to proceed further with this resolution.
Thank you.
Is this adequate? Can I be heard and recorded? Thank you.
Please identify yourself for our...
I'll do that. Thanks, Chair Barker. Hello, good afternoon, Chair Barker and the members of the committee. I am Mary Ginnane, resident of Salem, Oregon. In 2008-2009, I was president of the Oregon Library Association, and I'm here representing the Oregon Library Association today. I retired in 2010 after a 30-year career as a librarian, more than 10 of which I worked directly with children or managing youth services in a library to children and teens. Libraries, by the nature of their work in collecting, organizing, and disseminating materials on all points of view, depend on free speech protections in the Constitution's First Amendment and the even stronger protections in Oregon's Constitution, Article 1. The mission of libraries is fundamental to democracy, and upholding citizens' rights to read, view, and listen to materials of personal choice are a part of a library staff person's professional code of ethics. No doubt, House Joint Resolution 34 was not proposed to impact libraries or impede us in our mission to be a fundamental part of democracy, yet if passed, it could. Historically, the legislature has recognized that Oregon libraries need exemptions or affirmative defenses from prosecution for furnishing sexually explicit materials to minors. Sexually explicit materials written for minors or available to minors are in library collections, represented in art education, sex education, health, medical, and literary materials. And some of the books shown to you earlier today are examples that are on my list as well, so I won't repeat those.
Library employees believe children and teens deserve access to developmentally appropriate materials and that parents and caregivers are the best guides to materials that represent their family's values. Libraries do have policies and procedures in place for collecting materials and also to hear concerns about library materials to which local citizens may object. Choices to remove, retain, or reclassify materials are decisions that staff and citizen library boards and school boards can make. I respect and applaud that protecting children is the aim of this proposed constitutional amendment. All thoughtful, caring citizens of Oregon want children to be safe. Is there concrete evidence to show that this proposed amendment will decrease incidents of harming children? Lacking that evidence, it seems as if the proposed amendment could lead to problems for local governments operating libraries and could undermine important democratically based First Amendment rights. So thank you for your concerns. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer questions if any arise.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, panel. I appreciate your testimony. Next, called Dr. Tim Bloomer. And Karen Sheeler, please.
Mr. Chair, I don't think Dr. Blumer is here.
Okay. Karen Sheeler, please.
Good afternoon, chairs and committee. My name is Karen Sheeler, and I am the executive director of the ABC House in Albany, Oregon. And the ABC House is the local child abuse intervention center. We serve both Linn and Benton counties. And I'm here to speak to you today about what we see and be a voice for the children that we see who are victims of pornography. Over 75% of the children who are sexually abused and are seen for an assessment at ABC House have had pornography involved in their abuse. Studies tell us that pornography is not only stimulating to perpetrators, but it is used to demonstrate to victims what the sex activity is wanted. It helps to reduce barriers and inhibitions in children. And we have had over the past year an increase of children, and I can think of four very clear and distinct cases in which children were forced to view hardcore pornography and then reenact the things that they saw with their offenders. And when you hear a child who has to talk about first not understanding completely what they're seeing, being embarrassed by it, and then having to recreate those acts with adults, that is so damaging and so embarrassing and so difficult for children to talk about. Children also are sexual beings like each and every one of us, and there are times when they view pornographic material and they are stimulated by it. And then they go on to, as we in our building say, want to share what they've experienced, want to share the things that they feel, and then we are seeing groups of children who are acting out knowing that, not really understanding what they're doing, but engaging in explicit sexual activity with their peers or children younger. And that becomes a stimulation for them. They often know that they shouldn't be engaged in that activity, but they're curious about it and sometimes very stimulated by it. We call those children sexually reactive, and we know that it then takes quite some time to redirect to those behaviors, and it exposes multiple children. Pornography is used to really, truly desensitize children and teens. And it is much more available. When I spoke to our multidisciplinary team this week, I had a juvenile probation officer share with me that in the mass amount of their cases now, they are seeing their juveniles who are engaged in viewing a lot of pornography. They're coming to them, families with credit card bills in hundreds and hundreds of dollars monthly because their children have somehow found access, whether it's through the internet, purchasing pornography, viewing it on pay-per-view TV or direct TV. And it's devastated their entire family, not just because these teens are involved in it, but because it's financially put a hardship on families. We see those teens then acting out against younger children because they're stimulated and they're looking for victims. We know that a child introduced to pornographic material at a young age is confused, overwhelmed, repulsed by it, but as they go on to view it more and more, they become addicted to it. I will tell you that from 2007 to 2009, I looked at our juvenile offender rate, and each of those 3 years, 17% of the alleged offenders of the children we saw were juveniles. In 2009, there were 43 juveniles arrested for explicit sex crimes, and many of them had been involved in viewing pornography. That's 43 of our youth who are now in the juvenile justice system. We know that viewing pornography desensitizes and sometimes changes the hard wire of children, and many, many offenders, adult offenders, will tell you it began with pornography. Internet is such an accessible venue for pornography, and I ask that you remember these children and what happens when they are exposed to pornography and they are the victims of people. The question was asked earlier about drug homes. Methamphetamine users typically in our counties spend hours every day watching pornography, and eventually, because of the skew in the dopamine levels of their brains, pornography is no longer enough and they turn to children. And we see that in our building weekly, monthly, yearly. And I would ask you to really consider that when you make these decisions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'd like to ask you, Ms. Sheeler, if I could. So you said the children were sexually responding or something?
Some children do respond to, and we call that sexually reactive.
Reactive, that was the
yes.
Term. And I was just wondering, some of the books other people mentioned, which may or may not have been covered by this, but age-appropriate sex education, would that not help deter that if that was?
We do encourage age-appropriate sex education, yes.
Okay.
So that, and that helps children be able, and parents, to set boundaries. Pornography really decreases the ability of children to set appropriate boundaries for themselves. So, yes, we are always about age-appropriate materials.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on HJR 34. The next on the agenda, we'll open up with a work session on House Bill 2648. Representative Gelser and Bob Junedeff, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2648, if you'll recall, the original subject matter of the bill is no longer at issue or not at issue today. It was heard on February the 10th. Today, there are a couple of amendments to the bill because it has a relating clause that accepts the subject matter that's going to be talked about by Representative Gelzer and Mr. Jindal. They don't compete with each other, these amendments. They are standalone and independent and could both pass or one or the other. And I made a brief record on April the 13th. The Dash 1 Amendment replaces the measure and allows persons who use physical force in the care or supervision of incompetent persons to be criminally charged. The Dash 2 Amendment replaces the measure and requires a court to use start date that commitment began to grant day-for-day credit for time already committed when they're calculating the maximum amount of time a person may be committed due to inability to aid and assist.
Okay, thank you. And as you know, since this is what we call a gut and stuff, we just have a brief description of it, and then if anybody has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser from Corvallis. House Bill 2648, the Dash 1 Amendment, would put what was formerly House Bill 2823 into this vehicle, and it is a pure housekeeping fix. Currently, the law reads that a parent, guardian, or other person entrusted with the care and supervision of a minor or an incompetent person may use reasonable physical force upon them. This language was put into statute in the 1970s. We now no longer look at incompetent adults as children. These would be adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities. These would be adults with Alzheimer's disease. We are simply saying that, no, you can't spank them, hit them, physically move them against their will in order to discipline them, because we do not discipline other adults. And so it just simply removes the word incompetent person, leaves the word minor in there, so it does not impact the ability for a parent to discipline their child, just as you can't discipline your mom or dad.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Jundev, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundev from Disability Rights Oregon. The Dash 2 amendments address the following situation. In our laws right now, if a person is mentally unable to face criminal charges, they are sent to the state hospital or another treatment situation in order to be restored to competency to face their criminal charges. As a result of a Supreme Court case in 1972 called Jackson versus Indiana, there's a maximum period of time that a person can be held by the state for that purpose in order to restore them to face charges. And if the state is unable to do that within that time, that person moves to another status, oftentimes civilly committed. What we have found that in certain circumstances, a person is sent to the hospital for treatment. They are restored and they're sent back to jail, but unfortunately they decompensate when they get back to jail and they return to the hospital. This can happen multiple times, and as a result of how the time periods are considered by the state, people can end up in the hospital for longer than 3 years, effectively indefinitely if they keep going back and forth. So what the Dash 2 amendments would do would say that the three-year standard that we have that gives the state 3 years to restore a person to capacity, we need 3 years. So the state would have a total of 3 years in order to achieve that goal.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the member? Thank you. And we'll carry this over. It's not ready to be worked today. Close the work session on House Bill 2648. Another bill we're not going to hear today is House Bill 2479. And House Bill 3525, we were not going to hear today. We're waiting for Chief Justice Dimunis to be over here for that one. Open a hearing on work session on House Bill 2942.
Chairman of the Committee, House Bill 2942, we had a work session on this last week on the 1st of April. It comes from Representative Gelser. You have the Dashboard Amendments in front of you and allows a person who has been subjected to unwanted sexual contact within the preceding 180 days to seek court protection from the person who did the act of or alleged to have done the act. If the person has been convicted or charged with a crime involving sexual contact and the person menaces or threatens a person seeking court protection or the person's family. Chairman, as a committee, you have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which would have to be adopted. We have the amendments. You can adopt that, but at least as of the start of the meeting, we did not have the fiscal.
Okay. Okay, committee, as you recall, this is the case where FAPA would not apply on a restraining order because it was, where that has to be somebody who actually has a relationship with the other person. This was, we heard from a woman who had been raped. The alleged rapist was found not guilty, and because they had been intimate partners before, she was unable to get a restraining order under the FAPA, and that's what we're trying to do today, or trying to pass with this bill. So we need the Dash 1s in.
Chairman of the Committee, the Representative Gelson presented the committee at the last meeting with the Dash 1 amendments, so my assumption is that she would like to see the Dash 1 amendments adopted.
Okay.
And I assume the bill moved. But if we can't move the bill today, we can't adopt the amendments.
Okay.
Just put the amendments in. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2942.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2942. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And then I'll close the work session on House Bill 2942 and carry it over. Okay. Committee, stand at ease for a few minutes while we try to reorganize. And we closed the work session on House Bill 2479 and 3525, and I need to say we're carrying those over. Open a work session on House Bill 2103.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2103 specifies that persons convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants or whom are participating in a diversion program may use third-party resources to pay for the screening interview, treatment program, or diagnostic assessments. There is a Dash 1 which has been advanced, and it modifies line 6 and replaces any available third-party resource, including but not limited to, with as a third-party, deletes that and then adds as a third-party resource to support medically necessary chemical dependency services after the state medical assistance program. Basically what this means is this confines the effect of House Bill 2103 to allowing defendants to utilize as third-party resources the state medical assistance program. As amended, this is projected to have a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Dash 1.
That is correct.
Chair, I'd like to move the dash ones into House Bill 2103.
Representative Krieger moves the dash one amendments in House Bill 2103. Discussion? Objections?
Just to say this means that private insurance is not included as the third party.
Yeah. Co-chairs, Chair Krieger, yes, that's the intent of the amendment.
Can someone explain to me why we would exclude private insurance?
It would be another mandate that drives up insurance costs, which Oregon is famous for already.
And the allowing people to use third party doesn't sound like, with all due respect, Mr. Co-Chair, allowing someone to use insurance if the insurance covers it doesn't sound like a mandate to me.
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, I can respond to that only with testimony that was given, since that is essentially a policy decision, not a legal one. The concern that was expressed was that at this point, private insurers often use the fact of the conviction as a justification for the denial of coverage. This would then, disallowing that would sort of put the ball back in their court. If it was otherwise covered, it would then become a covered expense, rationale being if you come in with a legitimate diagnosis of an alcohol addiction, usually your insurer is going to cover you. So it would have, I think, the practical effect of causing them to cover something they are not presently covering.
In speaking with a representative from the industry, they felt that it's like somebody who's sort of outside the scope of your employment. They've got a drunk driving conviction, and that therefore they should be taking care of that, not the insurance company that, you know, would have the effect of raising the floor for insurance, a mandate that might raise the floor for insurance premiums.
One that I'm not sure
I concur with. Are there any objections to the dash one amendment?
I object to the amendment.
Okay, so noted. The amendments are in.
It is ready to work.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2103 as amended to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2103 as amended to the floor if it do pass. Is there any more discussion?
Do we have a fiscal on the amended bill? On the dash one amendment?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes, a minimal fiscal impact. It came in quite late. I can arrange you a hard copy if you'd like.
I now see it in my... Okay.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Excused.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
You ought to have Aaron carried on the floor.
Would somebody like to carry there? Representative Hicks.
Oh.
Okay. I thought you said that.
I said Garrett.
Oh, okay. Well, it's good try. Good try.
I did say Garrett.
Okay.
I'd be happy to carry it, Mr.
Chair. I'll be happy to carry it.
Open a work session on House Bill 2141.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2141 would prohibit the possession of intoxicants for both juvenile and adult diversion participants. There is an amendment to this. This is the dash three. The dash three makes a couple of important modifications. First of all, it provides, and this came up extensively at the public hearing, that a person may use intoxicants during the diversion period if it is sacramental wine given or provided as part of a religious rite or service, or if the person has a valid prescription for a substance and the person takes the substance as described. As amended, this House Bill 2141 with the dash 3 is projected to have no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
we will need to adapt the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash threes into House Bill 2141.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendment into House Bill 2141. Discussion.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yes. No, sir.
If I recall the discussion when we had the hearing, there was a question raised, and I don't recall how it was resolved and how the dash three amendment affects it, relating to members of the household and the definition of possession, and if someone else in the household has a bottle of beer that some of our colleagues might enjoy, how is that affected by this bill?
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, dash three does not address that concern.
So then, forgive my stupidity, counsel, what does the underlying bill do then to that circumstance?
Do you want to address
the interaction, please?
I see that we're not used. I don't see discussed. I see we're not used.
Yeah.
I don't see discussed.
Will not use or possess. That's line 13.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, I believe that the dash three also had possess taken out to address that concern. So it's just use, and the issue with possession was that it was a little harder to quantify possession for the very concerns that you're raising.
Oh, yeah.
Has someone scrutinized it for that purpose?
So we
identify yourself for the record.
Dina Ryerson with the Department of Justice. I'm sorry. No. I believe I looked at the dash three just this afternoon, and they had possess taken out of the dash three version. If you look in, it says use. It's in the main text of the.
Okay.
I wish if I can grab it, I can show you the line.
Put it on the record, so line and stuff. Thank you.
Yeah.
So on page two, on little d, it says, except as provided in subsection 5 of this section, agreement by the defendant to not use intoxicants during the diversion period. I think the original one had use or possess.
That's correct.
And then they took possess out of the juvenile code as well because it was in there, and then they took that out as well. And then the other change is, instead of as prescribed, it's as directed, which was a concern somebody else had as well.
Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you for the clarification.
Did Barbara put her name on quickly?
She did.
Oh, she did.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Ryerson.
Is this ready to go?
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Ryerson.
And we just put the threes in?
We just adopted the threes.
Okay.
Yeah. So now we got to move it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2141 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Do we need to move the dash three amendment first?
We did.
First?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We did. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2141 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative
Bolton.
Aye.
Representative Chaplin.
Aye.
Representative May.
Excuse.
Representative Vaughn.
Aye.
Representative Whitman.
Aye.
Co-Vice
Chair
Hicks.
Aye. Co-Vice Chair
Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair
Nolan. Aye. Nolan, would you like to carry the bill?
I think she would.
I'd be willing to, but carrying bills is not something that I aspire to. But I'm happy to do it for you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Open a work session on House Bill 3239.
Oh, yeah. Co-chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3239 would add sexual assault of an animal to the list of crimes that would require an individual, whether juvenile or adult, to register as a sex offender. This is the introductory version of the bill. It is expected to have minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Colleagues, as you recall, we had testimony in this bill, and we were spared the CD-ROM version of it. Is there any questions or discussion about the bill?
It is my understanding that this bill does not create the crime of sexual abuse of an animal, just adds it to the registry list.
That's right.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So I'm sorry, I lost track. Which amendment are we on?
None.
Without the amendments.
No amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3239 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3239 to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Shelton.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Excuse.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative
Newman. Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hick.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry that bill. Could you give them a slide? So I had in the day. So here's what we're hearing. Open a work session on House Bill 2217.
Chair, members of committee, could I just check a second?
Yes.
Hence, I just want to make sure that we had a hearing on this bill. Oh, I know what it is. It comes over from another committee. That's why, Mr. Chair. And they had a hearing there. Mr. Chair, members of committee, this exempts professional counsels in marriage and family therapists from punitive damage awards if they are engaged in conduct regulated by the appropriate governing body and they are acting within the scope of practice for which they are licensed. Mr. Chair, members of committee, this will add them to a long list of professions.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2217 the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2217 to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shelton.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Excuse.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Whitman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair
Hick.
Aye. I'm sorry, excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries, and we'll have Representative Buckley carry the bill on the floor.
Chair, members of the committee, the next bill I have that I'm staff on, we've had a hearing on this in March 11th, and this is a bill that transfers the Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee from the State Commission of Children and Families to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I just got a fiscal impact statement, and basically it says they would like this bill down in Ways and Means Committee if the committee so desires to move in this direction, because they have to figure out, they have to transfer positions and funds from one agency to the other in order to carry this out.
Mr. Chair, I had asked this morning whether anyone could contact Judy McMakin.
I called Mr. Chairman of the committee, but I didn't talk to her.
Okay.
So I'm glad to move it down to Ways and Means. Or do you want to wait?
Okay.
We'll close the work. Or we haven't even opened it. So we'll carry that bill over as well.
Okay.
3533. Yeah.
Musical chairs.
Chair Barker, I don't believe this bill has yet been called and it is ready to go to the committee is still inclined.
And it's a good stuff, right? Open a work session on House Bill 2662. Council, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2662 is a gut and stuff. The record was made previously on the 6th, and then we've been carrying it over while waiting for a fiscal statement to issue. It has issued, but if you'll note, it indicates there is no fiscal impact. The provisions of the Dash 1 amendment, that's the only amendment at issue, replace the measure and amend statute to allow state agencies to begin compliance with reporting requirements and extends a program for PSRB to conduct relief hearings, which would otherwise expire on January 2nd. 2012 to January 2nd, 2016. And I'll reread the background because it's been a couple of weeks with the committee's indulgence. Excuse me, in 2009, the Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 2853B, requiring the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Judicial Department and the Psychiatric Security Review Board to provide information to the Oregon State Police identifying persons prohibited from possessing and or purchasing firearms due to specific court findings related to mental illness in order to comply with federal law. PSRB is also required to conduct hearings at the request of persons subject to such provisions who are seeking relief. As written, both the relief hearing program and compliance with reporting requirements are contingent upon funding and rulemaking. This bill, as amended, House Bill 2662 with the dash ones, would permit immediate compliance with the reporting requirements and allow the relief hearing program to be extended another 4 years. And Mr. Yandell's in the audience if there were any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Yandell? Would anybody have any?
No, that's the dash one.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Yandell, can you come up, I guess? Representative Hicks, please.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Yandell, Director of the Criminal Justice Information Services Division for the Oregon State Police.
Mr. Yandell, hi. Brief question. Do I understand that if this bill didn't pass, does that mean the PSRB would no longer be able to do the gun relief program?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, the PSRB is ready to conduct relief hearings. They've actually had four requests. Your assessment is correct. Essentially, last session, we agreed to put the sunset in to give us an opportunity to come back if we weren't able to acquire funding. Between grant funds that we have received, and we're in the process of applying for a third year round of grants, and action the legislature took in January of last year. They're ready to conduct the hearings, but the program ends before it ever begins if we don't make this change.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Chairs, members, if I, sorry to interrupt, if I can make further record, there was on the original subject matter a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do have the permission letter from both speakers' offices that rescinds the subsequent referral.
Okay. And if this bill passes, which I expect it is, I think this would be appropriate to put on the consent calendar since this just catches us up to...
Gets us in compliance.
In compliance. So are there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
We have yet to...
I'm sorry.
Motion for...
Motion the dash
one. The chairs to...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have the dash ones put into House Bill 2662.
Thank you. Representative Krieger moves the dash ones into House Bill 2662. Is there any discussion? Any objections? If not, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2662 as amended to the floor if the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2662 to the floor as amended to the floor to the consent calendar.
The floor.
Yeah, consent with a due pass recognition. Call the roll, please.
Representative
Holt. Yes.
Representative Holt.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative
Comey. Excused.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Whitman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Put that on the consent calendar, please.
If you could send me these briefly, because I list of all, actually, you decide all the carriers.
We're going to stand at ease for a few moments to be sure we have all the bills that are going to be carried over so that we announce them properly. Call it, the committee's back in order. The following bills are being carried over. Some of them will work, but they will be back. HGR 34, House Bill 2183, House Bill 3204, House Bill 3525, House Bill 3595.
94.
I'm sorry, 94, 3594. House Bill 2142, House Bill 2648, House Bill 2650, House Bill 2662, House Bill 2693, House Bill 2694, House Bill 2942, House Bill 3295, House Bill 3533, and House Bill 2479. Is there any further business to come before the committee?